You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYNads.com.
We had actually a military class and teach you something about how to put on a gas mask to, well, how an American military unit would be attacking you and how that would be different from how a British military unit would be attacking you.
This is Cold War Conversations. If you're new here, you've come to the right place to listen to first-hand Cold War history accounts. Do make sure you subscribe in your podcast app so that you don't miss out on future episodes. Vadim was at school in Moscow during the 1970s and 80s. He attended an advanced English studies school where all subjects were taught, however the focus was on English. He provides us with insights into the setup of Soviet education, as well as the school life, teaching methods and pop culture. We hear how the British newspaper Morning Star was a key teaching aid for Soviet English students. Now, I know some of you skip this bit, but if you want to continue hearing these Cold War stories, I'm asking listeners to pledge a monthly donation of around $4, £3 or €3 a month to help keep the podcast on the air. Larger amounts are always welcome too. If you donate monthly via Patreon, then you get the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster, and you bask in the warm glow of knowing that you are helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate. If a financial contribution is not your cup of tea, then you can still help us by leaving written reviews wherever you listen to us, as well as sharing us on social media. It really helps us get new guests on the show. Peter Ryan is the interviewer today, and I am delighted to welcome Vadim to our Cold War conversation.
Vadim, maybe as a starting point, obviously Moscow is today and always has been a vibrant international city. Can you tell us a little bit about what it was like in Moscow in the 70s and 80s from the standpoint of the English language scene? Was there much of an English language scene? Was English readily available as a language of communication or as a language of media?
A very interesting question, Peter, because there are different viewpoints on that, whether you were a school kid like me back then, or a grown-up who kind of was looking to use English in their job. Again, my perspective was still a kid, so I went to school at the age of 7 in 1975 and spent 10 years there. Well, we can probably talk about the system of schooling a little more as we move ahead. But the idea is that there were different type of schools. Some were just sort of regular schools where kids would have maybe one or two classes of English per week, and obviously they were not really picking much speaking or writing skills during those couple hours. I was sort of fortunate because my parents put me in a school that was sort of designated as advanced English studies school. So we actually had it starting at the age of 8, which was in the second grade, unlike others who started like 2 or 3 years later. And we had 3-4 hours of English classes, solid English classes, pretty much from the age of 8. Again, can't say that this was really something that we were looking towards every day or every week. Like most other subjects in school, they were sort of forced on us as part of a curriculum. And I keep thinking of a Monty Python sketch from one of their movies, where John Cleese was actually doing a sex education class in one, was it like a Catholic school or a Protestant school, with a live demo. And the kids were all extremely bored just because that was yet another school subject. So that was sort of the mindset of, I'd say, a lot of kids, even in my sort of advanced English school, because parents were making the decisions, not the kids themselves. I was sort of pushed to be a good performing student by my parents, so I had to kind of excel in everything based on their viewpoints, and eventually, yeah, I had to put all the time in my homework, including obviously English as well. So, and ended up, well, do it pretty well. But some other kids, well, not that much. And interestingly, well, decades ago, later, we had like a school reunion, and talking to the former classmates of mine, I realized that barely 10%, even maybe less than that, actually had used English after finishing school, had any jobs, or well, one girl actually married a foreigner, quote unquote. I don't even know if he was American, British, or just European, but at least for her, that came in handy.
Sure. Yeah. Well, but it's interesting though, Vadim, in the sense that you were given the opportunity, or students in the Soviet Union were given the opportunity to learn English, even as you say, it might have been starting at 9 or 10 years old and a couple of hours a week, but it's certainly more exposure than, say, students like myself had to Russian in Canada, or I suspect it was the same across the West.
Yeah, that's right. And again, English was probably the more popular one, but kind of some schools were doing that with German, some with French. Well, there was probably even like one or two schools in Moscow where kids were doing Chinese back then. Mm-hmm. But, well, they, or actually their parents, had to be, well, especially motivated to put their kids through all the tortures of learning, well, such a difficult language.
But it's interesting, though, Vadim, when you think about it, the quality of the language instruction, we can hear it just from your English, was obviously very, very strong. And I can tell you as well, I've met many people from the former Soviet Union that speak French impeccably. It's quite, I think, a testament to the efforts that the education system made to try and make sure Occidental languages were given priority.
That's partially true, because, well, any foreign language would degrade very quick, if it's not used in kind of real life in a job, mm-hmm, or in actual live interactions. And I was fortunate later through my career to continue practicing both, well, at the university and then practicing that in real life, in a real job. And I barely had a job where I did not need it. That's kind of how it worked out for me. So yes, the foundation was decent, but again, You really had to have a need for that. But for the grown-ups, well, back then and even later, it was really kind of a doubtful motivation to put many hours in learning a language they may not even need. Well, Iron Curtain still remained a strong social factor, kind of focusing people on what's here, sort of, behind that Iron Curtain, which is the culture and social connections and everything that was happening in Russia. And even if you look at the current days, kind of the first decades of the 21st century, language is still a major social barrier. I mean, the Iron Curtain as we knew it from the 70s, 80s, and 90s is gone. But socially, well, the language barrier for a majority of the population in Russia is still a major factor.
Well, that's interesting. And when we're talking a little bit about language and language instruction and exposure, one of the big elements in terms of how somebody can take up language, and I'm sure it was the same case in the Soviet Union during the 70s and 80s, pop culture has a major impact on this. From the perspective of living in Moscow at the time, what would have been the primary pop culture elements that would have incorporated English into what you would have been exposed to back then?
Oh, that you're right, Peter. Yeah. Culture, pop culture, and especially imported pop culture is a major factor. But back then, most sort of pop culture elements were heavily curated. And anything that was allowed sort of into Russia had to be, say, politically correct and aligned, or at least not contradicting what the Soviet leaders back then were promoting or telling their people. So there were, obviously, kind of most of Western music, English language or in other languages as well, was under heavy control. I even remember that I once saw like a typewriter-written list of rock groups and singers who were sort of discouraged, quote-unquote, from being played in public performances, meaning like in clubs and discos, and under very weird pretexts. Obviously, well, groups like AC/DC or Kiss were... well, at least just because the old communist leaders were not really getting the metal or hard rock in at all. But some others actually got on that list as well. I think Pink Floyd got on it for I think condemning Russian invasion in Afghanistan, and they were really kind of got on that blacklist. Guys like Julio Iglesias, who was doing nothing but love songs, was on that list for, I think, due to some error. But at least he got, or his last name was mixed with someone else. But yeah, he was on that list as well. So
that's crazy.
That was kind of weird. Performers were on the white list, so to say, I think the star of Dean Reed, the American singer who originally was designated as a country style singer, but then he was kind of a major political voice of communism overall. At least that's how he was pitched to the Russian audience. He was a very iconic figure, or made an iconic figure, because obviously, his overall stance and appearance looked very positive, and generally, his sort of open nature in communicating, he generally projected a very positive impression, and that's why all the communist leaders really loved him for the opportunity to say, yeah, he's a real American, yeah, he holds an American passport, but he loves Soviet Union, he loves communism. So that sort of justifies pretty much everything we do here. So he was performing a lot across the country. I think he was even taken to this construction site of the Baikal-Amur Railway, like a major infrastructure mm-hmm. project that the Soviet Union was investing into back then. So I remember some pictures in the Pravda newspaper with Dean Reed performing on top of a railway car to the workers busy with this railroad construction. So yeah.
That's really incredible, Vadim. And you know, it's interesting, you mentioned some of the bands on the blacklist: AC/DC, Pink Floyd, Kiss. I'll say right now, those are three of my favorite bands, so I think I probably would have had a lot of difficulty visiting the Soviet Union back then. But, you know, it's interesting that you bring Dean Reed up, because there almost seems to have been a bit of a renaissance in interest around Dean Reed. If you find a lot of his videos on YouTube, a number of books have been written about him. I'm curious, from what you remember after he passed away in 1986, was he still remembered as fondly as he was perhaps prior to that?
It's hard to say, kind of, because I was going through some really kind of fast moving years myself, and my personal interests were shifting. Again, I wasn't really kind of a big fan of Dean Reed per se. So he was there, he was performing, he was sort of part of the culture scenery. But again, the seal of approval from the communist leaders kind of made me and a lot of other people doubt if that was really authentic. So,
right. So
they were pushing him too hard. That's my point.
Well, that's interesting, though. But let me ask you, in terms of some of the bands that perhaps were not as favored by the government, you know, going back AC/DC, Kiss, Pink Floyd, or other ones, what did young people like listening to? What would your peers and yourself have enjoyed listening to in terms of Western bands that perhaps their music made it through in some way, shape, or form? What would have been some of the more popular groups?
Yeah, well, obviously, kind of, we were all into music back then when we were just early teenagers, and as a backdrop, we all were really kind of dreaming of getting our own tape player. And again, obviously, it was all based on tape-based. And actually, the guys who had imported double cassette players, or actually kind of a recorder/player, they were really kind of the most favorite friends of everyone, because they could help kind of copy tapes and for everyone else. So, yeah. We were exchanging tapes, sharing records, and most of that was, again, as I said, on tapes. And you'd probably be looking at groups like Space or Doors, for that matter. But again, I hardly remember any names, because I was really coming from sort of a disadvantaged family to think of, because I was really the last one in my class of 38 people. Kids to get a tape player. So that was really kind of a major pain of my childhood. Yeah, everyone had one and I didn't. Interestingly, some records were actually released on vinyl by the official state-owned Melodia publishing house. And actually, remember I had a Beatles and a Doors vinyl discs, and maybe a few others. So I had this I wanted to say 45 RPM vinyl player, except that it was a 33 and 1/3. That was the standard, kind of more used across Russia back then. But yeah, I had a few of those, and yeah, obviously, kind of, there were other occasional opportunities to kind of immerse into kind of the pop culture that was coming out of the country. Obviously, the Eastern Bloc singers and groups were, well, reasonably popular, or kind of made popular for the lack of others. And there were even some TV programs like the Melodies of Rhymes of Foreign Music. That was, I think, how it was called. And that was like an annual program running deep into the night on December 31st. So you would really have to stay up till about 3 or 4 a.m. in the morning, and when this program would start. And the real excitement would be towards the end of it, more like, I don't know, 5 or 6 a.m. when they finally let in some Western European or American groups to play there. So that was exciting. Oh, and by the way, AM radio, it was still AM, not FM back then most of the time, but
you're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to lipsandads.com now. That's LIBSYN ads.com.
Despite all the attempts to hush down the foreign stations, there were actually some programs, news, culture, and music actually that were coming on BBC, on Radio Europe, Radio Free Europe, and even Voice of America occasionally kind of was coming through to those who had those AM radios. And fortunately, that those were not the days of the 1940s or 1950s when you were not supposed to own a radio at all. In the 70s, 80s, that was something you could buy at an electronics store, although they were not really always available there. You really had to line up like half a day for half a day to buy one. But my parents actually got an AM radio, which I occasionally used to tune into those stations, until they really had to hop to a new frequency every, 20, 30 minutes, just to avoid being kind of hushed down.
Got it. So, Vadim, it's interesting you mentioned the Beatles records. I'd heard from somebody that one of the, there's that famous compilation, the two compilation albums from the Beatles, the Red compilation, which is their songs from 62 to 66, and then the Blue one, which goes from 1967 to 1970. And somebody told me that there was an actual pressing done for the East Block on the Blue one that deliberately omitted the song Revolution. I don't know if you knew if that was true or not, but quite a fascinating story. Just to be able to sell the record in the Soviet Union, they had to take that one song out.
That is very feasible. Except that I think it wasn't their calling. It was still the curation of the material that was happening when they really ran the printing, or actually prepared this disc for release in Russia. I think the Communist Party curators had really kind of to strike out certain songs. I don't think the Beatles themselves did that.
No, I would imagine not. Well, let's shift away from music for a second. I'd be really interested in terms of the printed word. And what type of access did you, as a young Muscovite, have to perhaps English language books or magazines, whether they were printed within the Soviet Union or perhaps even imported from the West?
Well, again, locally printed media was definitely kind of much easier to get access to. And even for the English classes at school, our teachers occasionally, frequently recommended. I think Moscow News was a locally published newspaper in English. I think it was not necessarily kind of a strong on propaganda, but at least what they did, they tried to provide some sort of balanced view to those reading in English, obviously targeting the Western audience. But it was still published in Moscow and available in English and a few other languages through the newsstands. And obviously kind of written by Russian English speakers, very few native English speakers, I think, were part of the editorial board. But they provided still decent level of articles in terms of training your English skills. In parallel, Morning Star, famous communist British newspaper, was fairly easy to be found across the newsstands, and obviously kind of fully imported and written by their actual English speakers. That was even a better choice by our English teachers back at school. And not because of the communist propaganda in it, just because, purely for the pleasure of exercising your English.
I had heard that the Soviet Union was the largest single buyer of the Morning Star newspaper.
I totally believe that, because it was really widely available. Not every day I checked the newsstand, but at least kind of once a week or twice a week, you could actually get a new issue. And it wasn't really prohibitively expensive. Slightly more expensive than the Russian Pravda newspaper, but still kind of affordable. At least, you could save your lunch money and buy one with no big trouble. But then again, you would be reusing that for another month as part of your English classes and exercises. Sure.
But when you think about perhaps even going beyond the newspapers, I'm I'm coming to mind some of the big authors from the 1970s and 80s as an example. Stephen King, I remember when I was growing up, was massive. Would you have been able to get any of perhaps his books in English or any other offer?
I'll say in the early 90s, definitely. But again, there were different channels. First of all, part of the school curriculum, we were really encouraged to read books by like Jack London, Mark Twain, so the classic English-American literature, 18th, 19th century. And a lot of that was actually published in Russia.
Mm-hmm.
In Russia, in English. So, yeah, you could actually go and get one in the bookstore. Some other English literature, especially kind of classic British literature, was coming through sort of as an imported titles. I think Penguin Publishing House was really big on that, and a lot of their books were easy to be found in Moscow, both new and used ones, usually kind of paperbacks of different level. But again, typically those be 18th, 19th century books, barely anything, hardly anything from the 20th century. But still possibly, maybe if you really wanted to find it, you could. Secondhand market was already sort of legally available, or semi-legally available if you really were caring for any of those titles. A few years later, when I was already at the first year at the university, and again, my university path was it was called the Department of kind of International Affairs, so I was really kind of studying international banking and finance, I was supposed to. So we had advanced English studies there as well, and obviously showing a student ID of that university allowed me to sign into the, it was called the Foreign Literature Library in Moscow. So it was sort of available for most, but you really had to have, you know, reasons just to sign into the library. So if you're really doing other work or classes unrelated to foreign languages, they would probably decline access to that. But I was lucky to be on that sort of, again, kind of white list, so to say.
So when we think about the 1970s and the 80s, obviously one of the biggest elements around English language culture, popular culture that comes to mind would be cinema and television. And I think about perhaps TV shows like The Dukes of Hazzard. I think about movies like Back to the Future, Star Wars. Did you have access to any of these in English in Moscow at the time?
Well, I think that sort of came in much later. We're already talking about year 85 to 90, sort of. I actually remember skipping a few classes at my university because there was a kind of a trade show happening not too far from where my university was, which was actually some sort of not a trade show sponsored by U.S. Information Agency. So what they did was they brought in sort of a display of American culture, technology, and generally kind of the spirit of America to a very popular back then exhibition, which really took several hours really to get in. And that's why I had to skip those classes. But eventually I did. And that was, I think, very shortly after Back to the Future was released, at least the first of the three. And they were running that on a small TV somewhere in one of the booths out there, kind of like a three-minute loop or something. And that was kind of a shock to me. And a few years earlier, I remember actually seeing a piece of Star Wars movie in one of the, I don't remember what sort of event that was, but yeah, I definitely remember couple episodes there, and I thought, oh wow, I should definitely get to see the whole movie at some point. And it took actually decades till I had the chance to. None of the TV shows actually kind of were available, but I remember a movie, I think it was called Tootsie in Russian. A lot of American movies, or I think The Flight of Condor was some other one. I remember actually going to the regular cinema and see. Actually, together with a couple of my best school buddies, we occasionally took sort of trips around Moscow to see American movies, which were, again, released on a small scale, and you probably had to ride on a subway across the entire city to another movie theater, which was running certain American movie that week. So that was still possible, available, exciting, definitely so. Although I understand that some scenes, especially erotic scenes from some of the movies, were really gonna cut out to please the curators.
Got it. Well, interestingly enough, why don't we flip back a little bit to the education that perhaps you experienced or that other students in Moscow at the time would have been undergoing. From the standpoint of signing up for English classes or getting involved in extracurricular English activities, would that have been seen as suspicious by the authorities at the time?
Well, actually, no. Not really. Because I think a few decades before that, that probably would have been suspicious. But in the 70s and especially 80s, not anymore. But again, you had to understand why anyone would be doing that. So for the kids like me, it was primarily our parents' drive to put us in a school that was doing those extra English classes. And since that was, again, an official government school reporting to the Department of Education of the Soviet Union, I mean, there was nothing suspicious about that. Anyone taking, and I'm talking about the grown-ups, the adults who were taking, I don't know, after-work English classes and actually paid for that, that was, in most cases, either required by their job, or at least they could do there and still kind of explain why they had a strong motivation to do that. Like they were doing some science research or whatever that justified that. So that actually wasn't much of a problem.
So if we're thinking a little bit about the chance to learn English and to speak English, obviously you had some really good instructors and you had exposure to some printed materials as well as some movies. Did you ever get a chance to meet native English speakers during your time growing up in Moscow?
Well, actually, yes, and I mean, this wasn't really a regular event, but there were a few episodes I can still remember. Probably the earliest one happened when I was barely 8 or 9, and my mom and I somehow ended really in the downtown of Moscow, in the vicinity of a Metropole hotel, which was even back then was really kind of a posh international hotel for really kind of major foreign visitors. And there was like a small park outside with like a water feature and some rest area there where kind of my mom just landed to give some rest to her feet. And I, as a kid, was just running around, and there was a gentleman. Again, I wouldn't remember which country he came, but at least after kind of a few rounds around that water feature, I ended up exchanging a few sentences with that gentleman and then reporting back to my mom and then making another round and a few more sentences. So all in all, that was, I would say, fairly uncontrolled interaction. I mean, there was no KGB officers lurking in the bushes nearby, and my English was barely sufficient to say a few words. I mean, I just started learning in the internet. Only I could only say my name and where I live and sort of and a few other basic things. But I kind of still remember that interaction.
Was there any sense about what the gentleman was doing in town, or what perhaps his business was in Moscow at the time?
Again, my English was barely sufficient to understand him at all, and not to probe those in-depth questions. I was still 8 or 9, and I was excited already to be chatting with a real foreigner. Even if we were talking about, well, I live in Moscow and my name is Vadim and I live nearby and everything, I wasn't really asking much. He was kind of doing the questioning there. But, I know, to me, he could have been one of the just tourists coming to see the air, Moscow, the country, and the city. I occasionally could spot a few other similar tourists kind of in the same area. I mean, that was really kind of the downtown next to the Bolshoi Theater and Kremlin just around the corner. So it was really kind of a hot spot in that sense. Interestingly, back in my school, we were sort of designated, I mean, our school with advanced English studies was sort of a designated as a model school, in a sense, to where they would be bringing the teams of school kids, and usually kids, school kids from Europe or US. And I remember we had visitors from UK, from US, from Netherlands. Here's an interesting story. Our school was originally designed as a not just an advanced English language studies school, but probably decades before that, the kids were also supposed to study other subjects like chemistry or physics or history in English. So it wasn't just the English, but also English chemistry or, probably even physical education in English. I don't know. But apparently they had problems sourcing teachers that could do both, I mean, deliver physics or literature and speak English. So it eventually kind of went down to just English classes. But officially it was still known as the school where they study multiple subjects in English, and all the kind of nameplates and we had on all the classes and rooms were in English as well. So we actually had a gym which said in English, which had a word gym on it, G-Y-M, and not kind of a sports hall in Russian. And we had a physics class and had all other classes also labeled in English. And we had actually a military class, and kind of military education, a military, basic military training was part of the regular, kind of mid to high school agenda, where once a week they would teach you something about how to put on a gas mask, to an American military unit would be attacking you, and how that would be different from how British military unit would be attacking you. I mean, all those weird topics. But that room had that military room label on the door. And eventually, they started covering that with a piece of paper on the days when those foreign visitors they were coming in. And that's how we knew, okay, we're probably going to miss a class or two, because they would just pull us out of the class to chat with these other kids from London. And we were really excited. But again, that was already sort of mid-school, high-school years, which still made us feel happy when we could skip a test by just chatting to those visitors.
Oh, that's classic. Well, Vadim, tell me, how was the instruction in English undertaken at the schools that you attended? Were there any particular ways that they not just taught you the language, but they made you fluent? You've alluded to the fact that you were effectively immersed in different subjects, but were there ways of making it interesting and challenging the students to not just have a functional element of the language, but also to become more fluent by their own volition?
Hi, this is Rhonda in Virginia, and I support Cold War Conversations because I think the work that Ian is doing is critically important. I think it's vital to record the firsthand accounts of people who lived and experienced the Cold War because it illustrates history in a way that a book never can. So thank you so much for the podcast. It's my favorite podcast, and I look forward to it every week.
To be like Rhonda and help to preserve these incredible stories of the Cold War, as a monthly or annual supporter, you'll be able to listen ad-free, you'll become one of our community, get the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster as a thank you, and you'll bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate to find out more.
Unfortunately, I wouldn't say that was the case. Well, obviously, the story about all other subjects being taught in English, that kind of started and ended before I actually went to school. So, with just English language classes, a lot of time was spent on teaching grammar and rules and other boring topics, probably taking away the time from live conversations. So I had really to study all those past perfect continuous versus present perfect continuous and draw all kind of tables and how those verbs would differ depending on this time. We still had some spoken practice with the teachers between each other. But again, another big chunk of effort went into memorizing what was called topics, which essentially meant you'd be learning literally by heart anyway from like 2 to 3, 4, 5, 6 paragraphs of material. And gosh, I still remember a few of those talking about either the City of London or talking about the Mark Twain's literature. And eventually they would be using that on tests where the kids would really be out there speaking in memorized sentences without really even understanding what they were talking about. And that was considered to be a worthwhile investment of efforts. So I would say it wasn't as much fun, although possibly still useful.
I would say so. And tell me, Vadim, to what extent did you find that the instructors were fluent in English themselves? To what level would you have accorded the instructors in terms of what they were able to do in regards to not just teaching English, but actually interacting in it?
Interestingly, I didn't have a scale to measure their accents or their mastery of the language back then. To me, they were really much better than myself, and that was sufficient to really get us speaking whatever they could share with us. I would say not all of them were equally good, but again, our school was probably one of the fortunate ones, and at least several of the teachers that we were in class with had been on some sort of teacher exchange programs in UK, I believe. So at least they would know where their own position was in terms of the English language accents and skills. Some were really kind of doing just okay, but it was really the choice we could make, like I'll go with this teacher versus I go with that other teacher, because it was all kind of pre-planned, and once you are in our school, or once you were in our school or any other school, you really had your curriculum pretty much scheduled out for the rest of the term and the full year, meaning that the planning unit was not an individually personalized curriculum for each of the students or kids. It was, again, for the entire class of maybe 30, 35 kids. Mm-hmm. So you'd go into the class, you'd go out of the class just because you were designated to be that school by your parents, and that's the schedule for today. Not much choice.
Cool. So to what extent did ideology pervade instruction in English? Were there elements of the Soviet, perhaps, propaganda or the policy direction that you had discussed in the classes, whether it was subtly or directly?
So very interesting question, but no, not really. I mean, the English classes were mostly focusing on just the skills and learning a few useless material topics, but the propaganda itself was not really there. You really had to dig deeper and see that, okay, most of the reading material, even in English, comes from the 18th and 19th century. And and the Uncle Tom's Cabin was probably the most politically biased material, because that depicted the slavery, and we in the Soviet Union were so heavily against slavery for equal rights of all the people. I think that's probably the most obvious case, but not much in the other day-to-day classes per se. There was enough, I would say, communist and political propaganda outside of the classes themselves. Like, the spirit of collectivism was something you would be seeing from the very first year in the primary school. Everyone was supposed to be part of a small team or small group, where you had your own responsibilities. You were really modeling yourself by the heroes of, they were still called pioneers, sort of modeled by the scouts, I guess, in US. So they were kind of an organization like the pioneers, which really kind of promoted both the ability to find your way in the forest or set up a fire to cook some food, but also to really help the elderly and do other good for the sake of your of the Communist Party and your other international friends. so we were all part of that, later as we were then promoted to the Komsomol members, which is already sort of a next step in the youth organizational hierarchy. So it was still kind of a communist party-led organization, but again for the teenagers and young adults. There were a lot of events, meetings, and other types of propaganda coming through those channels. But again, hardly anyone knew any better, so it was still fairly neutrally accepted. Like, yeah, it's part of life. I'm not going to protest against it. I'm just stick with whatever everyone else is doing. At least that was sort of the mentality back then.
So, Vadim, final question. And by the way, thank you. This has been a fascinating discussion thus far, and really appreciate your time. I'd be really interested to find out if, by what you observed, there was any shift in how English was taught or the exposure to English after Glasnost and Perestroika kicked off, all the way up through to the fall of communism.
Well, I think one of the major shifts that happened was due to the fall of that Iron Curtain, when the citizens of the Soviet Union and now Russia now finally discover themselves still to be part of the bigger world. And that revelation pushed a lot of enthusiasm into learning foreign languages, primarily English, of course, just to maintain cultural and social connections. So that was a major push, which again got reflected in many of the, say, commercially available English language studies schools. I'm not sure about the primary education. There are still schools that were not putting much time and effort into specifically the English language curriculum. Some were doing that kind of a little more. Some were saying, yeah, we're now going to offer multiple languages because, well, the whole world is at your fingertips. But yes, there were much more opportunities and a lot more motivation to go after those opportunities. So that, I think, was a major shift. Until probably, I'd say, 10 years ago when, well, U.S. was declared the major enemy of Russia again, and the Iron Curtain started sort of coming back.
Got it. Well, look, thank you so much, Vadim. Thanks for taking part in Cold War Conversations.
And we have further photos, videos, and information on this episode in our show notes, which we'll show as a link in your podcast app. Now, this podcast would not exist without our generous Patreons, and I would like to especially thank our Politburo level members who contribute a generous $30 a month each to help keep us on the air. They are Tony Sowards, Sam Hardwick, Nicholas Butter, Jeffrey Jones, Matthew Comstock, Frederick Esposito, and Peter Ryan. Don't forget, if you'd like to get one of those Cold War Conversations coasters, help keep us on the air, then head over to coldwarconversations.com/donate. If you can't wait for the next episode, do visit our Facebook discussion group where listeners just like you continue the Cold War conversation. Just search for Cold War Conversations in Facebook. Thank you very much for listening. It is really appreciated. Goodbye. Not enjoying the ads? Well, you can avoid them by going to coldwarconversations.com/donate. By becoming a monthly or annual supporter, you'll enjoy ad-free listening, become a part of our community, receive the sought-after Cold War Conversations drinks coaster, and bask in the warm glow of knowing that you're helping to preserve Cold War history. Just go to coldwarconversations.com/donate for more information.